You're about to join Niels Kostrup Larsen on a raw and honest journey into the world of systematic investing and learn about the most dependable and consistent yet often overlooked investment strategy. Welcome to the Systematic Investor Series.
Welcome or welcome back to this week's edition of the Systematic Investor Series with Alan Dunn and I, Niels Kostrup Larsen, where each week we take the pulse of the global market through the lens of a rules-based investor. Alan, great to be back with you this week. How are you doing? And more importantly, has Dublin recovered after St. Patrick's Day?
Yeah, it has. Yeah, it was pretty quiet weekend. We had success in the rugby, that was the main highlight. So we are the Six Nations champions, but we're well back to normal here by now.
And I know you and I spoke actually yesterday, and you said you had snow early in March. That's quite unusual.
We did. We had snow all winter, and then on the 1st of March, at least a couple of inches fell that morning. But now today, lovely sunshine here, so definitely feels like spring is certainly in the air.
I can tell you that Switzerland today really feels almost like summer. It is very nice, I have to say. Anyways, we have a few topics that you kindly brought along, so they'll be interesting to dive into. We don't have any questions, but as we always do, we start off with hearing a little bit of what's been on your radar recently or since we last spoke. What's catching your attention at the moment?
Well, it's been a very interesting week. In the last week, we've had the monumental ending of ZIRP in Japan, which was obviously long heralded, but I suppose it is certainly a noteworthy historical event. But then, just as interestingly, in the week where the Bank of Japan raises rates, the Swiss National Bank went and cut rates. So, I mean, and the Fed were on hold. So we had the full spectrum of actions from central banks. So I think it really does highlight a couple of things. You know, we've been long talking about the desynchronized cycles, and I think that's pretty good evidence of it. You know, one central bank easing, another one hiking in the same week. I mean, I saw an interesting chart from Peter Berzin at BCA, who we've had on Global Macro before. And actually, historically, when Japan has hiked rates, it's tended to be just before the global economy has gone into recession. So it remains to be seen whether that's a good indicator. And speaking of indicators, I saw an article there just before it came on that 2-10 yield curve in the US is inverted for the longest it's ever been inverted, well, at least relative to the data that they had. So certainly a lot of interesting stuff going on from a monetary policy perspective and a markets perspective. One other interesting story I just picked up on this morning, and it was about in Japan. Obviously, we've had an end of zero interest rate policy, and also inflation has, the reason we've had that is because inflation has started to pick up, but also starting to motivate a change in investor behavior in Japan. And this Bloomberg article was highlighting that there's 1 quadrillion yen in bank deposits in Japan. Now, I had to go and look up what a quadrillion is because there's a lot of zeros there. So basically, it's, let me get this right. I think it's 1,000 billion. Yeah, that's what it is. So that's about a $7 trillion US dollars equivalent in yen. So the point is that, you know, all joking aside, that's, you know, pretty big number. And if we did start to see, you know, Japanese investors doing something different, you know, the amount of cash they hold is about 62% of their total assets. So it's very high relative to international norms. So, you know, potentially that could start going into the stock market, or else, you know, it could go overseas. You know, a lot of people have been expecting a rebound in the yen on the back of, you know, normalization of interest rate policy in Japan. But there is also now a sense, well, maybe they're not going to tighten that much, and that might be it for now. And we've got this wall of money in Japan. Okay, maybe it's too aggressive to say that it's going to start moving somewhere, but at the margin, it does sound like that investors are now changing their mindset, given that you've got higher inflation. So I think that's a really interesting story, something to keep an eye on going forward, because, as I say, the general sense had been when Japan raises rates, money is going to flow back, but maybe that won't be the case. We'll have to monitor that one.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think we'll talk a little bit around this in some ways, maybe when we get sort of to your big macro picture in a couple of minutes. It is interesting, of course. You mentioned that Japan has been hiking, and the Swiss National Bank surprised, I think, a lot of people yesterday when they cut. What's also interesting is that both the yen and the Swiss franc is down 1.5%, more or less exactly the same in the last week against the dollar. So that's an interesting outcome. But of course, as you say, other things have done well. I mean, European stocks, Japanese stocks, US stocks are all making new all-time highs this week. So yes, I mean, 2024 is turning into a very interesting year for investors, that's for sure. Now, let's just swiftly move on to something incredibly related to what we've started off talking about. And that's kind of as we normally do when you and I talk, and just talk a little bit about sort of your big picture framework. Obviously, you have the luxury of talking to some global macro thinkers in between when you do your recordings. I'm sure maybe some of the conversations makes you think about some of these topics in a bigger sense. So I'm curious as to where we're going to go today.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to focus in on one element of what I'm seeing and reading and hearing, and I agree. I mean, ever since, you know, we had that pivot from the Fed at the end of last year, and equities started to move up, and we've, you know, I suppose more and more evidence so far. I mean, it's a work in progress of the soft landing, and people have been saying, well, you know, what's the historical parallel? And you know, people like Chen Zhao, who's been on with us from Alpine Macro, have been making the case that actually maybe the parallel is not so much with the 1970s or post-World War II, but it might be the mid-1990s. That could be the historical parallel. And the reason for that is obviously that was the one tightening cycle where the Fed did engineer a soft landing. If you go back to 1994, rates were, raised very aggressively in that year from about, you know, I think it was 3% to about 6% or so, maybe 5.5%, 6%, and equities took a bit of a correction. Not, I don't think as much as 2022, but it was a tough year for bonds. And then, as soon as the soft landing was achieved, and as soon as the Fed stopped tightening, the equity market took off and bonds recovered, and we started to see that to an extent. We've also had a few more parallels. I think we obviously productivity growth has been very, well, has been strong in the last few quarters, having been very weak. And people point to AI and say, oh yeah, sure, AI, you know, productivity, of course, is picking up. But I'm a bit skeptical as to whether AI has actually contributed to productivity growth yet, but you could make that case. So certainly there is that parallel being drawn from some commentators, like, are we in a scenario similar to the 1990s or the late 1990s? And I think, yeah, you can draw that parallel in terms of the soft landing possibly on the productivity side. I mean, the question then is it more like 1995 or 1999? Because obviously other people are saying, well, you know, pointing to bubbles, and that's something I wanted to talk about as well. You know, a lot more talk in markets about bubbles, which kind of surprises me a little bit, because yes, S&P 500, you know, forward PE is high, but not as high as, say, 2021. So we've had more elevated valuations in absolute terms. Maybe in relative terms, it might be a different story. But in absolute terms, it's not as high. And I mean, that whole question around, are we in a bubble? Are valuations high? Got me, you know, thinking about, you know, the past and looking back to what the period of the 1990s. And of course, people who were in the markets back then will remember Greenspan's famous speech around irrational exuberance, which was in December 1996. So at the time, the Fed was worried about, you know, was the equity market in a bubble? And, if you read around what the kind of the Fed was debating at the time, there was this debate as to, you know, were valuations too high and what should they do about it? So they got like people like Robert Shiller to come in. They had a meeting of all the good and great on Wall Street around what their views were around valuations. You know, people like Abby Cohen, who was a big cheerleader for the bull market back then. And, you know, there was no particular consensus reached. And Greenspan wasn't quite sure whether he should be kind of talking down the market. And then famously, he made a speech in December 96 where he said, he kind of asked the question, was the market subject to irrational exuberance? The market sold off initially, but then absolutely skyrocketed after the fact. Like, so that was December 96. In 97, the market was up 31%. In 98, up 27%. And in 99, up 20%. And after he spoke, the market doubled, more than doubled. So it was just, it's interesting. I don't think you could say we're in a bubble at the moment looking at the market as a whole. I mean, certainly valuations are expensive relative to history, but you know, we're not seeing the bubble-like behavior like we saw back then. But certainly the conditions could possibly come into place to fuel that kind of book. I'm not predicting that, but I'm saying you could conceive of it. And particularly, you know, back in that period, there was that debate about with the central banks being just purely focused on inflation. And if you're going to cut rates because they say, well, inflation allows it, you know, by cutting rates, you could be adding fuel to an equity bubble. So I think that's the scenario that I think about, you know, if we do actually see these rate cuts coming through, even though, even though growth is still fairly solid, just because inflation has come back down, you could have all of this debate revisited again. So what does that mean from a global macro look? I mean, I think we're in a holding pattern. You know, the data is still pretty solid. Lots of people still looking for, you know, an eventual softening of the data in the labor market, but we're not there yet. And obviously, if you look at the Fed's projections this week, they're actually getting more upbeat on economic growth and they're nudging those growth forecasts higher and the rate forecasts higher. So for the moment, you know, Goldilocks is still in play. So unless we see either much stronger growth to take rate cuts totally off the table or much weaker growth, for the moment, it's hard to stand in the way of the equity market rally. And that's what a trend following position is doing for you at the moment. It's just keeping you with the trend for the moment. And it's hard to disagree with that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, I guess the reason why part of the conversation we see nowadays is focused on this, you know, are we in a bubble? I guess you could say that certain things looks like they're a little bit in a bubble when you look around the market. I mean, clearly this AI-driven thing is in a bubble. And I'm gonna get into massive amount of trouble when I say this because I really have no idea about individual stocks. But I did pick up someone saying that if you look at NVIDIA has been kind of the poster child for this AI rally. I'm pretty sure he said that about 78% of their revenue comes from data centers that they have built out, which has nothing to do with AI. So kind of interesting that they are the poster child for AI. But in any event, as I said, I'm probably not the best person to talk about these things. There's a couple of other things. We are talking about sort of a global macro picture. I was telling you before coming on before we pressed record, a couple of interesting things just happening today, Friday. One is that Putin apparently has come out saying that they're no longer doing a special military operation in Ukraine. They're now at war with Ukraine. I think that is an interesting change of language. And I also think from memory, from the early days of the war, that it changes certain authorities that he gets in Russia in terms of getting people drafted for as soldiers if it's a war versus if it's an operation, something like that. Maybe I'm completely wrong here. And then the second thing that I thought was interesting is that there's some news out just as we speak, where, according to this source, which is a Danish newspaper, that the US is asking Ukraine not to do these deep into Russia military operations where they target oil installations because they're worried that Russia will then retaliate and hit Western oil installations, and that's going to drive up the price of energy considerably. So all to play for here, I think, in terms of what markets can do as we head into 2024. But I want to take you back to something you kind of mentioned a little bit, but I actually think it's quite interesting. Something that I've been hearing more and more about on a few podcasts that I've been listening to, and that's the whole topic of liquidity. And I think and you know what? I think this is an episode that hasn't come out yet, you know, that we actually have to re-record because the quality wasn't good enough. But anyway, in that conversation, I mentioned something that I had just heard, not just I heard, but came out about the change of the US balance sheet, the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. And the idea is here that they have been forced to fund themselves at much shorter duration because last year, essentially, bond markets collapsed when they tried to sell a lot of long-term debt. And I was listening to actually one of our former guests, Michael Howell, who's you know, an excellent person when it comes to topics of liquidity, and his firm, Cross Border Capital, specializes in this. Now, he estimates that the world has to refinance something like $70 trillion every year for the next 5 years. But at the same time, Janet Yellen has decided to move most of their refinancing, which is not the way it's normally done, but she's moving most of the refinancing into the shorter end of the curve. Which, by the way, also means, you mentioned the yield curve has been, you know, inverted for the longest time. Well, I think his argument is that it's being artificially inverted because they're restricting the issuance of longer-term paper that drives prices up, yields down. So that helps with the inversion, right? But if you look at another yield curve, the question is, are you looking at the right yield curve when you say about the inversion? So I think it's very interesting, and I think obviously closer to your home, what we saw in, it must have been, what, September 2022, when the gilt market collapsed due to the fact that Liz Truss was trying to introduce some unfinanced tax cuts or whatever it was. Essentially, the bond market reacted and basically threw that idea out and her at the same time. So I'd love to hear your thoughts about, if you have followed this a little bit, in terms of what you think all of this may lead to, because one of the things that I seem to remember is that a lot of the crises we end up getting and having, a lot of them is really refinance crises. I mean, it's to do with not being able to issue debt at levels you expect them to be accepted by the market. So is this something you're keeping an eye on?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different points here. I think the first one around Yellen and the US issuance. I mean, I have seen people looking at this and saying basically it's the Treasury kind of taking control of monetary policy a little bit as well, from the perspective of, you know, you're doing quantitative tightening, which should be a force for nudging up long-term bond yields. But then by tactically, you know, issuing at the short end instead of at the long end, you're basically providing a bit of balance to that and taking some of the pressure off long-term bond yields, where the whole point of doing that is to, you know, tighten financial conditions gradually. Obviously, you don't want an exaggerated move at the long end. And maybe there was the concern as we were in kind of August last year when 10-year yields in the US hit 5% that it was going to become unruly. So I can see that. But I mean, yeah, it is this issue of kind of fiscal dominance, you know, and who's actually controlling monetary policy and economic policy. Is it more Janet Yellen or is it the Fed? So I think that's one point. I mean, I think in terms of refinancing, I mean, I don't have the stats to hand, but it's certainly something we've talked about before. We talked about it with Christopher Zook at CAS. Come up a number of times. I mean, there's a huge amount of refinancing in commercial real estate in the next number of years. That's already leading to strains in that market. And I think in certain segments of the corporate bond market, obviously a lot of this stuff was, refinanced around 2019, 2020 in particular, when rates and yields hit extremely low levels. And very often it's of a kind of a 5-year tenor. So kind of this period of 2024, 25, 26 on that commercial real estate and corporate side, that's certainly a theme. Now, the question is that systemic? I mean, the issue was it was largely U.S. Regional banks that were going to be impacted for that. I did see actually a story on Bloomberg. I think it was actually Ontario teachers were selling a building in the U.S. for a dollar because it was going to cost them more in terms of refinancing costs and all of that, and a refurb was probably needed. So nobody was going to take it on without basically getting it for nothing. But that kind of highlights the extent of the challenges in the commercial real estate market. So I think that's a second stress. I think a third kind of theme here that we might hear a little bit more of is, you know, as these, you know, if you're doing your issuance at the short end, and as interest rates are coming up at the short end, you know, there is this, there's the cost for the central bank now of paying these higher rates on an ongoing basis. And, you know, so we're seeing kind of negative losses basically at central banks around the world. Now, strictly speaking, it doesn't matter, you know, and that's always been the theoretical argument. Central banks don't even have to be solvent. They certainly don't have to make money. But, you know, in the kind of populist perspective, you know, when you hear that the central bank is losing money and practically is no longer sending a check to the Treasury every year to kind of buffer the coffers, you know, that becomes more of a political issue. So I think certainly central bank mandates could come under stress in relation to that. And I think that's another theme related to this whole interest rate readjustment that we're seeing that we're going to hear more about.
All right, let's move on in our line of topics. Talk a little bit about trend following for a change. So far in March, it's been, you know, not as buoyant as we saw in February. February was pretty extraordinary, but it's still pretty good. Solid performance so far, which I'll come to in a second. As far as I can tell, people are still enjoying the trend in cocoa. That's still in force, very much so. And of course, we have equities as a sector doing really well. And then a few other markets, Mexican peso has been pretty good. Maybe some of the trends that we saw early in the year, like short grains and stuff like that, has petered out a little bit. That's probably being replaced to some extent of some long-term biases in the energy sector. And I mean the oils, not the gases. So so far so good. Looking at the numbers, and these are as of Wednesday, because they are not out just yet for Thursday night. I think Thursday, by the way, was a good day for trend followers and CTAs. But as of Wednesday night, B Top 50 was up 1.5%, up almost 7% for the year. SocGen CTA Index up 1.75% for the month, up 7.8% for the year. SocGen Trend Index up 1.75% as well, up 9.6% for the year. And the Short-Term Traders Index up about 0.5%, up 1.1% for the year. My own trend barometer, by the way, finished yesterday at 43, but it has been up in the 50s during the last few days, but has come off a little bit the last 2 days. Anyways, MSCI World also enjoying a good month so far, up almost 3% for the month, up 8.38% for the year. World government bonds, fairly quiet, up 22 basis points in March, and the S&P 500 Total Return Index up almost 3% so far. As of last night, up 10.25% so far this year. Anything that you're noticing about CTA's trend followers, Alan?
No, it's been a very good start, obviously. And I mean, I guess the noteworthy thing is kind of the breadth of trending activity across markets. Obviously, you know, cocoa has been the headline story in terms of a really exaggerated move, but equities as well, you know, even, you know, metals, obviously gold has been trending very nicely. And some of the other markets, copper started to move up a little bit as paused. And as you say, energies as well, for some managers, has been a more important driver. So, you know, as we've been talking about, it's not a kind of the typical kind of crisis alpha risk off type of phase, but it is a period where we're seeing a lot more trending behavior in an environment of positive equity return. So I think that's interesting, and it's probably, you know, so the magnitude of some of the returns we're seeing across the industry. You know, we're seeing like up 10% in the first 2 to 3 months of the year, and it's kind of like doesn't sound too unusual. If you went back a number of years, that would have been a headline that CTAs are making a comeback. So I think it's just all in the picture of the normalization of the trading environment that we're seeing in the recent years, that we're seeing this kind of, you know, okay, I wouldn't say consistency. Obviously, the returns are still episodic, but the fact that we're seeing now another burst of positive performance is reflecting that environment.
Yeah. I don't follow this, but I wonder what the chocolate factories or companies are doing in terms of share price at a time when, I don't know, the price of cocoa has gone up 300% or something like that by now. Anyways, I'm sure someone out there will know and share that with us. All right, you brought along a few topics that we're going to be diving into. Some of them I managed to sort of have a quick look at, but certainly the first one, it was so long that I gave up. So I'm going to let you lead the way. We're going to be talking about the outlook, I think, from the perspective of UBS.
Well, it's the outlook and it's the history. I mean, this is now the UBS Investment Returns Yearbook. It was historically the Credit Suisse Investment Returns Yearbook, and obviously now UBS and Credit Suisse are one. And this is, as you say, it's a really long document. It's published every year. The people behind it, Dimson and Marsh, and there might have been a third person, they wrote a book in 2000 called The Triumph of the Optimists, which looked at long-term equity and asset market returns. And ever since then, they've been producing this annual reference book. And it really is a great reference book. So if you can get access to it, I'd certainly recommend it. But I just thought worth kind of picking out a few of the interesting insights that come from it. Because, you know, I've often on this podcast talked about, you know, what are the long-term return expectations for the different asset classes? And the last time we were on, we were talking about two different research papers on that. So definitely interesting to get their perspective on that. And also if they have insights as to, you know, what the outlook is going forward. So a few things that I picked out, you know, when they look back, they look at the asset market returns back to 1900 and a pretty comprehensive data set. And not all markets were continuous through that whole period. But in the US, equities produced 9.6% annualized over that whole period. And that's a 6.5% real return, which is very consistent with the Jeremy Siegel's estimate. And very often that's the number that people think about. If you say, well, what's the long-term return on equities? You know, 6.5% real or maybe 9-10% nominal. But an important point that they make is that number is very US specific. That if you look at the equity returns around the world, it's not as strong everywhere else. So certainly the US is unusual in that respect. Actually, the rest of the world, ex-US, annualized 4.3%. So that's actually a fairly meaningful difference between the US and the rest. Now, what do you do with that? That's, I guess, an open question. Is there going to be reversion to the mean? Or does that just reflect the fact that, you know, the US is the most progressive, most open, most capitalistic market that lends itself to generating better returns in equity? So that's a call you have to make. But certainly in terms of formulating a return expectation for the very long term, like a pension fund might have to do, probably would be make more sense to be a bit more cautious and tilted towards that kind of global return as opposed to taking the US return.
Quick question for you here. Do you know, and I could be completely wrong, but is it true that the US equity total valuation is something like 60% of global?
So that was one of my other insights to share.
Okay.
And the US market is 60.5% of the total world value, which is extremely high. I think it's the highest they have in the data. The next biggest is Japan, 6.2%, which for a single country, obviously Eurozone was the Eurozone, but for a single country, it's Japan. Back at 1990, when Japan was at its peak, it accounted for 40% of the total world market. So this is a highly unusual that the US is so dominant. If you go back to 1900, the US was 14.5% of the global market and the UK was 24%. So the UK was the biggest trading nation and, you know, obviously the reserve currency back then. So highly unusual that the world is so dominated by the US equity market. And of course, within the US equity market, dominated by a small few stocks. So
Do they break that down as well?
I haven't. I'm sure it's there somewhere, but I didn't get it in terms of what those individual stocks are.
No, because a lot of people talk about this concentration risk. We've never seen so much concentration because if 60% of the US market, if the US market is 60% of the world market, we know that the Magnificent 7, 6, 5, however many there are left, has a very large share of that, which means that you have, you know, a handful of companies making up a huge percentage of total global equity capitalization.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, no, for sure. And I mean, there's different views on that. It, obviously, some people say, well, that's just the nature of how the global economic system has evolved, that you have these big, you know, heavyweights that have built moats, you know, have built these businesses that are going to be around for a long time, that are effectively more significant economically than many countries. And that's, you know, so yeah, I mean, mean reversion is a theme that runs throughout their paper. So, I mean, I would have thought that if they were to make a call on that, it would be more likely that won't be sustained, because they also talk about the sectoral composition, that how that's shifted over time. So, for example, if you go back to 1900, the market was dominated by the railroads, and in the US, about 80% of the market back then now doesn't even exist now. They're all kind of these, they're kind
same
of small industrial
energy
type markets.
A few decades ago, right?
Exactly. So obviously, what we spend our money on now is totally different. Obviously, technology is the big component of the index, but that is something that shifts over time and it naturally kind of evolves.
To interrupt you again, Alan.
Yeah.
But it's kind of interesting as you're, you know, sharing this insight. I'm thinking of the headlines that I'm seeing at the moment in the papers about, you know, maybe there is an attempt to break up Apple, right? With all these antitrust lawsuits now being filed in the last couple of days. These leaderships change over time. Who knows? And it reminds me about what happened. I'm sure you remember everything that happened with Microsoft and Bill Gates back in whatever it was, the 90s, with all these antitrust cases.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Some of the other points that they make, it was interesting, you know, we talked about that difference, between the US 6.5% and the rest of the world 4.3%. I mean, that doesn't sound that dramatic, but it just, to highlight the power of compounding, a dollar invested in the US grew to $2,443 in real terms, whereas at the 4.3%, it only grows to 191, so less than 8% of the value. And that just shows the power of compounding when, you know, applied to a very long time period. And even like you might think the difference between 9.6%, which is the nominal return in the US, and 9.1%, which is the nominal return in the UK over the period. So you say, well, that's about the same, you know, a little bit less, not much. But in terms of compounding over that period, you know, the US dollar grew to 87,620, where the UK pound grew to 49,404, just driven by that 0.5% difference. So it does really highlight for long-term investors, eking out those small incremental gains is so massively important when they get compounded over time. Of the other important, interesting points from it, I mean, we talk about long-term, and they make the point that, you know, you really have to take a very long-term if you're thinking long-term. You might think 20 years is a long time or 40 years, but as we've said many times before, you know, the last 40 years have been unusually favorable for financial assets, you know, because the starting point was, you know, of say, the starting point is 1982, 42 years since then, bond yields were at their peak. So it was a phenomenal time. And that's borne out by the data. So they point out that, you know, I think in the 40 years to the end of 2021, world bonds generated 6.3% real versus 7.4% for equity. So, okay, granted what comments we made about compounding, but I mean, not far off for a lot less in terms of volatility. But that's an unusual 40-year period. If you go back over the full 100 years, they significantly underperform. So that's an important point to highlight again, that within that 124 years, you have smaller periods. Obviously, you know, the lost decades, such as the early 2000s. And, you know, they do highlight the magnitudes of the drawdowns, which are very eye-opening when you look at them again. In the US, the largest drawdown in real terms of over 80%. In the UK, not so long ago, 50 years ago, 70% drawdown in 1973, 1974. And equally, like, investors in some countries have lost everything, like Russia and China in 1917 and 1949. Basically, the market disappeared. So equities, yeah, the returns are there for the long term. Stay buy and hold, but it's not without risk. And, you know, we talk about drawdowns and managed futures and trend following. Nothing of that magnitude in terms of 80%. And interestingly, you know, on the EM theme, you know, actually developed markets have outperformed emerging markets over that period as well. And they have a mechanism of, you know, categorizing emerging markets at that time. So it's like, you know, obviously market that now is developed was emerging at certain points back then. But it does highlight that, you know, that risk in emerging markets, the fact that, you know, one or two might go completely bust is interesting. They also talk about inflation, and in the inflation side is interesting as well. You know, to look at the kind of the average inflation rates. In Argentina, since 1960, inflation has averaged 71.6% on an annual basis. So, I mean, not hard to understand why Argentina has economic challenges. But interestingly, if you look at the US, on average, between 1900 to 2023, inflation is 2.9%. So that's interesting, because if somebody was to say, what do you think inflation will be for the next 10 years? I would say, well, probably 3%. And that's obviously, we've had periods of lower and higher and deflation as well in that decade. But actually, the US is one of the lower countries. If you look at places like France, Spain, Italy, they're all, I think French inflation has averaged 6.6% over that whole period as well. They also point out that, you know, this idea of our equities and equity hedge, and they kind of were negative on that from the perspective of equities do beat inflation over time. But in the years when you're suffering that high inflation, equities tend to do poorly. So not so much a hedge as more of as an asset class that can, over the long term, withstand inflation and do better. But in those years when you tend to have higher inflation, the assets, they highlight the assets that tend to do well, obviously commodities and gold as well. They also had an interesting section in it on looking at the returns in periods of rising rates and falling rates, which is obviously very topical at the moment. Yeah, and I guess unsurprisingly, you know, equity returns are a lot stronger when rates are rising, and that's even taking the starting point once the rate hike or the rate cut has happened. So not taking account of expectations around that.
So and in the UK, can you just actually, repeat that, all of them, Alan? I just want to make sure you said it the right way. Can you just repeat what you said about when equity returns are strongest?
Because strongest when rates are being cut. Hopefully,
exactly. Yes.
If I didn't get that right, strongest when rates are being cut, less when they're being raised. And in the UK, actually, almost all of the returns, you know, have come when rates are being cut. I don't know if that'll be the same, if that changes now that everything is so analyzed and people anticipate the rate hike or rate cutting cycle, but certainly a huge kind of bias in that way. And then finally, just in terms of kind of forward-looking expectations, to talk about what their estimates are for kind of the equity risk premium. And they came down, you know, considering a lot of different factors, for the world equity risk premium of about 3.5% over bills, which is less than what it's been historically. Historically, it was about 4.7%. So still, you know, good returns, but certainly consistent with the idea that valuations are certainly on the higher side, not saying necessarily a bubble, but certainly on the higher side, and return expectations should be accordingly lower looking forward.
Yeah, that's a fascinating piece of information, I have to say. I really appreciate you sharing some of these highlights, because it is actually quite a long piece of research, and it's interesting that they have all that historical data, I think. So, I mean, based on what we just talked about, you would think that you should put all your money in equities to some extent. So I'm kind of thinking you may have something up your sleeve to that point.
That's right. So that was the perfect segue into what I wanted to talk about next, which was the obvious implication is you just put all your money in equities and you ride out the volatility. And that's indeed what some researchers in the US were highlighting recently, which prompted Cliff Asness at AQR to write a blog piece about. And so basically, it was an academic piece done on looking at, you know, obviously a lot of money is managed according to kind of target date type mandates, you know, so you where the asset allocation is set according to your age. So if you're far from retirement, your portfolio will have more equities. And if you're getting closer to retirement, more bonds. And this study kind of questioned whether that was actually the right method. And they were saying actually an all equity portfolio, if you diversify globally, did better, obviously. Admittedly, it probably had higher drawdowns. And then Cliff Asness his point is so the question is, should investors be 100% equity? It's like, so it is a valid question. Like, and a lot of people would say, yes, you know, just be 100% equities, because that's what the equities have historically been the asset class with the highest returns. But I suppose the point is, yes, they are the one with the highest returns, but they're also maybe the highest risk. Now, it depends how you measure risk. Is it volatility or not, or drawdown, or what? And I suppose the point is he's making, it's no surprise that the asset with the highest expected return has had the highest realized return. I guess more generally, he makes the point about that if you're, I guess certainly if you're an institutional investor, actually you can make a case very easily for not being 100% equities because, as you know and as we know, if you combine equities with something that's uncorrelated, you can generate a higher Sharpe ratio. You know, so whether that's a 60-40 portfolio or maybe equities plus trend following or something like that. And then what you can do is lever that portfolio up to the same volatility as equities, and you'd actually get a higher return. So in that instance, what he points out is, I suppose this is one of the basic tenets of modern portfolio theory, that, you know, what you should do is formulate the best Sharpe maximizing or the best, most robust portfolio that's most diversified, etc. And then the second question is, well, how much of that portfolio do you want to hold in risk terms and lever it up or down according to your risk profile? Whereas kind of what you tend to find in the asset management industry and the wealth management industries is, if you want to take more risk, get more equities. If you want to take less risk, it's less equities. In actual fact, it should be a diversified portfolio levered up or down. Now, you might say, well, a lot of investors can't get the leverage, and that's a valid point. Like, if you want to lever up a portfolio, the obvious way to do it would be to, rather than buying the S&P 500 ETF, you would buy the S&P 500 futures, and then you'd have some spare cash that you could go and invest elsewhere. So this is the whole idea of capital efficiency, what people are now calling return stacking, etc. And that's a valid way of doing it. Now, a lot of people will say, I don't know anything about trading futures. You know, how do I do it? And so I think this is where it gets interesting and maybe links to kind of some of the issues around trend following and manager selection. And actually, one way you can get that leverage or build more leverage into your portfolio is when you're selecting your alternative strategies or your diversifying strategies, is to allocate to the more higher vol strategies and the higher vol managers within those categories, because you're basically getting the leverage from that manager. So you don't have to go lever up your portfolio. You're basically allocating to a manager who is doing that for you, and that creates the capital efficiency. And that's something that, I looked at some stats around this, if you, for example, if you just invested between equities and the SocGen trend index 80-20, yes, it improves your return, it improves your drawdown. But if you go and invest in equities plus a 1.5 time levered version of the SocGen trend, you get a much higher return and you still get the benefits on the drawdown, etc. So it's something that, you know, it's one of these kind of issues that I think it's interesting. I talked to Peter Madsen, one of the allocators, recently. It's like the disconnect between what makes sense from a pure portfolio perspective, you know, selecting uncorrelated assets, but trying to get as much volatility from them as possible. The reality is people don't do that. Why is that? I think it's like things like career risk. It's not wanting to fail, you know, unconventionally. It's, the line, looking at the portfolio on a line item basis rather than saying we're getting this capital efficiency from the high vol strategy. Instead to say, oh, we're getting this massive drawdown here at this point in time, and forgetting that they're making money on the equity side at the same time. So he raises a good point. Yeah, just because equities have the highest kind of historic return doesn't mean it's 100% equities. There are things you can do. Obviously, leveraging your portfolio is the obvious way to kind of balance that off. But there are other kind of practical techniques that even the kind of an investor who is limited to investing in funds and can't lever, they can actually achieve much the same of that leverage by actually finding high vol strategies that are uncorrelated with equities. And obviously trend following is one of those. And it does kind of highlight the benefit of within the trend space of selecting managers who do run at a reasonable level of volatility.
I completely agree with all of these points. And also the reasoning why you mentioned that investors, and in this case, institutional investors, are way under-allocated really to alternatives and certainly to trend following. We know that for sure. But when I hear the reasoning, and as much as I agree with them, you would think, well, people who work as PMs or CIOs or sits on an investment committee at a big institution, they're all very well educated. They know all this, right? They know not to look at line items. They know it's about what the portfolio improvement is. And they also know not to look at a Sharpe ratio on a single item, because Sharpe was not invented for that, frankly. So why do you think they still don't do what they should? That I don't understand.
I don't agree that they all necessarily know. I mean, I think there are, if you look at kind of the multi-asset space, very often people come from a fixed income background or an equity background, and people are always kind of comfortable with what they know. I think there is an element of lack of knowledge around maybe some trading strategies. Yeah, I think the behavioral biases, the career risk is certainly part of the story, but it is an interesting question. I mean, I do make that point when the simple maths show the benefit, but yet why are so many people underallocated to it? So I think it's a combination of reasons.
It reminds me of certainly one investor, famous investor, who probably knew that the evidence was suggesting that diversification is a good thing, but clearly he didn't want to embrace diversification. And that's Charlie Munger. I think he was out always saying that, you know, the trade-off between safety and return, et cetera, that he just didn't believe it in, and you should just stay fully invested in equity. So, yeah. Now, we've talked a little bit about sort of the challenges that some of these portfolios have and how they should embrace alternatives. So why don't we dive into another paper you found, which kind of highlights the issue, because if you have decided that you want to diversify, if you have decided that, yeah, probably in the world of hedge funds, somewhere there should be something that would work well for you, you need to kind of have a framework for picking, well, which hedge funds and what's their role in this portfolio and so on and so forth. And you found a paper on that topic. So why don't you share what you found?
Yeah, I came across this paper from Wellington, obviously a big US asset manager. And I mean, it's not a very scientific or detailed paper. It's more of an educational...
It's a good reminder of a few basic things.
Yeah, more of an educational piece. But I did think it had an important message in there, but equally raise some other points as well. And it's about, can hedge funds play the role, is what it's called. And I think where it wanted good is that, you know, very often you hear these very broad brush statements like, oh, well, maybe you should allocate 5% to hedge funds or 10% to hedge funds. But I mean, that's obviously literally a meaningless comment from the perspective of there are so many different strategies. And they point that out, that, I mean, there's make the, I suppose, point that, when investors are constructing portfolios, they're typically looking for either return consistency or return enhancement or diversification or downside protection. So when you're looking at the various building blocks, you got to think about which strategies can help you achieve it. So they kind of start off from the perspective of, if you take an equity portfolio or a fixed income portfolio or a 60-40 portfolio, you know, which of those is that good at, and then where are the gaps? And obviously, I guess with a 60-40 portfolio, you've got your equities for growth, you've got your bonds for diversification and for downside protection, and maybe for consistency. Obviously, we know there are issues with that's not a given as well, because that only works in a kind of a growth shock environment, in an inflation or supply shock environment. Your fixed income is challenged as well. But then the question is, well, okay, if you're going to look at strategies like equity long short, event driven, macro, relative value, you know, where do all of these fit in? So I thought it was good in the sense of highlighting that don't put your equity long short into your diversifiers. It sounds pretty straightforward, but, you know, I have seen it in multiple asset allocation plans, like 5% to hedge funds, and within that, you know, market neutral and long short. And I mean, sometimes that's behavioral, because it's managed as an alt portfolio, and they want to have kind of a reasonably consistent return within that. So that's fair enough. But I think in terms of managing from the overall portfolio perspective, that doesn't make sense. Anything that's equity biased should be in the equity bucket. And things like, obviously, macro, and that they don't specifically talk about trend following or managed features, but that is in the broad macro category. I mean, historically, that would be in, I guess, the downside protection and the diversification. But, you know, as we're seeing in the current environment, you know, and a conversation I was having with one allocator that'll be coming out soon in the allocator, you know, they could equally be seen as return generators now. You know, go back 5 years, it was harder to convince people of that, but we always knew that an environment where you get strong trends in a pro-risk environment, it can contribute as strongly. So I think...
I have one question for you, you go through these strategies. And I think they raised the point, but I didn't read the answer that they wrote. But it's something that I come across a lot because they are so popular at the moment. And that's these multi-strat funds that, you know, where do they fit in all of this? Can you even categorize them, except maybe for return consistency, I guess?
Yeah, I think it's a good point. And it's something I think about too, and I get asked by investors the same question. And I suppose that there is this general question that if something kind of fulfills a couple of different mandates, then how does that play out? Or is that a good thing or a bad thing? You know, I suppose you could ask the question, are they more growth or defensive? Or could you construct a portfolio of, say, a growth asset and have some diversifying strategies with that? Would that do as well as a multi-strat? Probably, I would guess. You know, so the question now then is of having this multi-strat that has the, you know, growth and some consistency, well, that's good. But are you going to have the downside protection from those kind of multi-strat products? I think that's somewhat questionable. Like, obviously, I think my sense is a lot of those strategies did reasonably well in 2022. But actually, if you go back to Q1 2020, a number of these types of strategies got stressed during the basis trade issue in March 2020. So are they really, you know, a strategy that are going to be bomb-proof in that type of scenario? I'm not sure. So I certainly wouldn't be holding a lot of that multi-strat type exposure in the kind of the downside protection bucket. That's not to say there's no role for it, but I think it'd be more tilted towards your return enhancement element. I think as well, like, all what they've done here well is highlight the general point. I suppose what they haven't talked about at all is what we were talking a little bit earlier, is things like sizing, you know, and how much. You know, what we tend to see is maybe the 5% allocation, the trend following, you know, why isn't it much higher? You know, so they don't bring in the discussion around what level of volatility, how much leverage. And I think these are all kind of the next level up in terms of constructing a good portfolio as well. And then I think as well, you know, arguably you could probably be more dynamic in allocating across the strategies as well, from the perspective of, you know, if volatility is unusually low, there might be a case for tail risk protection type strategies. Whereas if it's higher, you know, the hurdle is going to be greater. You know, if interest rates are higher, you get a higher return in trend following and managed futures. So that can be an additional reason for putting it in the return generating. So I think there are kind of tactical tilts you can make depending on the macro environment. But I thought this was a good starting point, but it's kind of like maybe building a liquid alts portfolio 101 or 201. It's a bit better than you see in a lot of places, but there's a lot more to think about than just, I suppose, the role of each of the strategies.
I mean, unfortunately, I forget the name of this hedge fund manager based in Spain, I think. Well-known, it just escapes my brain right now. But I remember that he's written and talked a lot about this idea of different strategies from the perspective of, if you're constructing a soccer team or a football team, as we would say. I'm sure you know who I'm thinking about and how the various strategies would fit a place on the pitch and so on and so forth. And I think sometimes these analogies can be helpful for people to understand the benefits and the purpose and the role, as they say.
Wait, is it Diego?
It was Diego. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We should come up with more analogies.
Yeah, I mean, I think
would the rugby analogy be?
A really good question. Yeah,
they're all in the scrum somewhere. You know.
Yes. Good. I'll have to think about that. You put me on a spot. I mean, it's interesting. You talk about Diego, and I mean, we've had this David Dredge as well, yeah. The goalkeeper type analogy for the tail risk protection. Do you need the midfielders? I suppose the point is, you have different strategies that can play multiple roles, but still you'll have debates among asset allocators and about how to use them. And I think that depends on, you know, if you're a long-term compounder or if you actually want a bit more consistency in return generating. And a lot of people say, consistency, it's all about staying the course, managing the vol. But actually, you know, we often forget that actually for a lot of investors, because of their behavioral, because of their makeup, they actually like consistency and performance. Nothing wrong with that. It's just constructing a portfolio that best suits the investors' needs. So I think that's the important takeaway as well.
Yeah, yeah. But at least we have seen some developments in our space, I guess, from people who have, as you said, stacked returns together. It's nothing new. It just came back a few years ago to the forefront, and now there are products out there that kind of does the work for investors, where they can just choose one ticker and they get the benefits of putting at least a couple of non-correlated return streams together, and it makes a lot of sense. At the end of the day, if more investors would invest like that in the long run, that should be that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the challenge is that by doing that, you're using futures markets, you're using leverage derivatives, and these are all, you know, kind of highly charged expressions. You know, I think, like, even Buffett has called derivatives weapons of mass destruction. You know, so when somebody is
he's using them himself to a high degree,
exactly.
Which
yeah.
is kind of funny.
Yeah, so it's always a matter of how they're used, you know, and in what context. But absolutely, you know, I think this idea that the pie is only 100%, and it doesn't make sense to lever beyond that, is not correct. But but you have to know what you're doing. I think that's the other point. It's not something, you know, the risk is you lever up, you have a lot of the same exposures in your portfolio and you lever that up, and that's where you run into problems. Obviously, the benefit of combining trend to following, say, with equities or bonds or whatever, is they're naturally uncorrelated.
I can think of a few pension funds that have come up publicly and said, "Oh, we're going to lever up our portfolio." One of them being the largest Danish pension fund a couple of years back, and they managed to lose 50% of their reserves in 1 year, namely 2022. And then when the bounce back came last year, they only made like 5 or 10%. You know, so clearly they could have used a little bit of a few other types of players on their team. Anyways, Alan, as usual, fun, insightful, great stuff. Anything else you want to bring up as we wrap up? Anything that you've been inspired to share before we
tried to think, was there anything that we didn't get to speak about?
I think we followed the outline pretty
yeah,
well.
I think
but
so.
There could have been yeah. something else that came to mind as we were talking.
No, I think that was it.
Okay, good stuff. All right, well, with that, Alan and I are going to wrap up. As usual, we would be so grateful if you would go to your favorite podcast platform and share a rating and review. It really does help us become more visible to more podcast listeners, so we would appreciate that. Also, as usual, you can send questions for us to info@toptradersonpluck.com. The next guest or co-host will be Mark. As you know, Mark has decades of experience in this industry, so if you want to throw some challenging questions at him, then now is the time, and the sooner I get them, the better. Then I can organize my line out for next week. In any event, from Alan and me, thanks ever so much for listening. We certainly look forward to being back with you next week, and in the meantime, as usual, take care of yourself and take care of each other.
Thanks for listening to the Systematic Investor podcast series. If you enjoy this series, go on over to iTunes and leave an honest rating and review. And be sure to listen to all the other episodes from Top Traders Unplugged. If you have questions about systematic investing, send us an email with the word question in the subject line to info@toptradersunplugged.com, and we'll try to get it on the show. And remember, all the discussion that we have about investment performance is about the past, and past performance does not guarantee or even infer anything about future performance. Also understand that there's a significant risk of financial loss with all investment strategies, and you need to request and understand the specific risks from the investment manager about their products before you make investment decisions. Thanks for spending some of your valuable time with us, and we'll see you on the next episode of The Systematic Investor.